You're listening to a 3CR podcast created in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
Welcome to Breadline from the Australian Unemployed Workers Union on Community Radio 3CR.
So put down that job plan and listen to us.
I'd first like to acknowledge that this program is being broadcast from the lands of the Wurundjeri of the Kulin Nation. So their sovereignty was never ceded, and we want to pay our respects to their elders past, present and emerging. And we also acknowledge that the unfairness of the welfare system disproportionately affects First Nations people.
Yes, welcome my friends to another instalment of the Breadline program, which is brought to you by the Australian Unemployed Workers Union, presented today by me, Hank. This week you will hear two speakers who are addressing the problem of we, the unemployed and poor, that we have to face our punishment and criminalisation for the sake of profiteers, exploiters and gentrifiers by the government. Last Friday, I went to the Victorian Trades Hall Council for an event relating to government unemployment and policies. It was about job guarantee. So here we have, with no further ado, Professor Bill Mitchell from the University of Newcastle, who will give a very nice summary, knowledgeable summary of how we got to this terrible system of the so-called workforce plus mutual obligations and the way we're treated at the moment, which you would have heard last week, all the terrible things happening to people who are having their dole cancelled illegally. So let's start and we'll listen to Bill Mitchell.
Professor Bill Mitchell is Professor Emeritus in Economics at the University of Newcastle, Director of the Centre for Full Employment and Equity, and a world-leading economist on full employment and job guarantee policies.
Thank you. Okay, so this is just a few reflections on history, the work I've done over my careers to date. If you think about the Great Depression, this was when a major paradigm shift occurred in macroeconomics at this point. And it was debated through the Great Depression because at the early days of the Great Depression, the British Treasury view reigned supreme, that the problem of mass unemployment that was emerging at the time was due to excessive real wages, which is the current mainstream, by the way. And so in the early 30s, they cut real wages, they engineered cuts in wages so that the real wage would fall, and of course unemployment continued to rise. And it wasn't really until the prosecution of the Second World War, the massive government investment in blowing each other up, that the mass unemployment of the Great Depression ended. And of course what was known then in that period between the two views, eventually, governments worked out that they had the capacity in their fiscal policy capacity, government spending and taxation, to do something about the unemployment. And they brought in, they had a large-scale job creation programs. And, you know, go around the world, you can document massive advantages that were achieved, legacies that were achieved from mass public sector job creation during the Great Depression. If you go from the period 1945 to approximately 75, 75 is just when Malcolm Fraser became Prime Minister in Australia with Philip Lynch as his treasurer, who led the Razor Gang, it was called in those days, where they just hacked to pieces the public sector. If you go through this period, that's approximately three-decade period, there was what I call an implicit guarantee of jobs. The public, within the public sector, and that was the only reason we had true full employment during that period. The private sector didn't employ everybody to create that below 2% unemployment. The standard public sector didn't do it. It was this buffer of jobs that would fluctuate. And moreover, there were jobs in, before Keating hacked into the local government employment through the so-called national competitive policies, which really just handed public money to profit-seeking private corporations. You could always get a job at the council yards, in the gardens, on the rubbish trucks, all over the place. So, you know, I lived out in the eastern suburbs and you could always go up to the Waverley Council Depot, City of Waverley Depot, and get a job. That was an implicit, it wasn't explicit public policy, but it was implicit guarantee of full employment. And all through the ministries, the big infrastructure ministries, housing, roads, you were able to get jobs just like that, bang. If we go to the 70s, there were a number of schemes that Whitlam brought in. One of them was the Red Scheme, 1974. That employed something like 85,000 people in a very short time. And you say, okay, what? And you know, the Conservatives criticised that relentlessly, but what did it do? All these lazy bums on the Red Scheme, working every day, bringing money home to their families through public sector job creation, leaving legacies for the state. Massive advantages. Of course, that was scrapped by Fraser and he brought in, you know, wage subsidies. What a joke. And at the same time, there was also the NEET scheme, the National Employment and Education Training Scheme. And eventually the CES in Geelong got sick of me being on Red Scheme, and NEET scheme gave me a chance to go back to university. And lots of other people were able to retrain and pursue their fulfilment. Government sector scheme. And then, of course, the paradigm shift occurred around 1975. It was already occurring within the Whitlam government, by the way, when they sacked Jimmy Cairns and that awful fellow Bill Hayden came in. And his final budget in, I've got a feeling it was July, it might have been late July, because they sacked Cairns in June. His final fiscal statement, the budget statement, was the first time in the history of documentation of those statements where they started to say, oh, the deficits are too high, we've got to worry about inflation, we've got to cut back and pursue surpluses, blah, blah. So it really happened under, and that was when Clyde Cameron, of course, introduced the term dole bludger as the Minister for Labor at that time. And that was the start of the point of the construction of the unemployed as lazy, indolent, unskilled bludgers. Labor did it. Clyde Cameron. And, you know, there was a whole then. That was when the Labor Party lost the plot too. But the paradigm shift occurred on the left as well as the right. And this was when the left started. There was a famous book by James O'Connor called The Fiscal Crisis of the State. He was a socialist, for God's sake. And this was a book saying the narrative was that the government, national governments who issue their own currency can never run out of it, suddenly have all these fiscal constraints and they've got to tighten up. And, you know, we had James Callaghan in Britain in September 1975 at the annual Labor conference. He was Prime Minister of Britain, saying the thought that governments could do something about reducing unemployment, that's gone. We can't do that anymore. What governments have to do is fight inflation. And in the academy, of course, by then, these politicians had just been infested by what was going on in the academy. Monetarism under Milton Friedman was taking over the academy. And in the labour economics area of the academy, this was really influential in my early academic career because I was a labour economist and a macroeconomist, am still. And this new idea called the new labour economics came in 1971. And the new labour economics said that unemployment is a choice by the unemployed between labour and leisure, and because they make a choice to be unemployed because they get more value out of not being employed than earning a wage and buying other commodities that they might be able to buy with their income. So as soon as it becomes a voluntary choice, and it was an the academy kept saying to their students in this new labour economics, it was an optimising choice. Okay, well, optimising choices are great. That means we're getting exactly what we want. And at that point, the concept of mass unemployment disappeared. And policymakers then shifted, bought the fiction, and started to say that, well, you know, we've got these lazy, unskilled characters living on the dole. We've got to make it much harder for them to live on the dole, and we've got to give them skills so that they can go out and get jobs, because we don't want them on the dole. We don't want them making choices like that. And so that led to the whole supply shift to supply-side thinking, that unemployment was a supply issue, the withdrawal of labour by these unemployed people, and that the solution to it was to pernicious reciprocal sort of reciprocation type policies to earn income support, to receive income support, and training schemes, so relentless churning through ridiculous training schemes that did nothing. And you can't search for jobs that aren't there. The basic intuition that if there's not enough jobs, all you're going to do is train someone up to be better than someone else so that they'll take the scarce job and the other person will miss out. And during this period, the last point here, during this period, we killed off manufacturing, which is another story, and we invented a new industry, and that doesn't appear in the ANZIC code, but it's a new industry called the unemployment industry. And we created a whole lot of parasitical private organisations, which were used to be called the Job Network, it's now called something else. And the whole system is just a corrupt system that does nothing for the unemployed.
You're listening to a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We need your financial support to keep going. Go to www.3cr.org.au for more information and to donate online. Now stay tuned to hear the rest of your 3CR podcast.
So there you have it. There's a system. It's corrupt. The whole system is corrupt. And that's coming from an Professor Emeritus. The whole system of the way unemployed people is corrupt. We have it. He talked about from job creation programs after World War II to punishing the unemployed for fluctuations in the wage slavery market of which they have no control. And interestingly, the term dole bludger, blaming the victim, us, was first used by Clyde Cameron of the Whitlam government. Yes, you're listening to Breadline on 3CR, and Danielle specially requested that station ID so we could hear Daryl's voice, and he's away this week, unfortunately. And we'll be talking about housing next. I was lucky enough to go last Thursday night to the Footscray Safety Forum, where there were lots of interesting speakers talking about the problem of the, let's say, attack on homeless people. We will hear from Shifra Bluestein, as we, the unemployed, are always at great threat of homelessness, of course, because of our low incomes, which, of course, our money should be raised like yesterday. Here's a way local governments have worked out to criminalise the poor and promote gentrification. Pretty useful if you're a parasite, right, or a rich person. So here we go with the Footscray Safety Forum.
Maribyrnong Council resolved to implement a program whereby security officers would accompany bylaws officers in the CBD as they patrolled the area. Now, just what these security officers will do, how they will do it, the limit and the extent of the powers and capacity they have not yet been made clear to us. Shifra Bluestein is the managing lawyer at the Inner Melbourne Community Legal Centre in North Melbourne, and she's also a long-term Footscray resident and really concerned about the criminalisation of poverty, making poverty and homelessness a crime, racialising people, and people also concerned about people with mental distress.
So I'm talking from a legal perspective, and from the outset it's really important to say there are real concerns about the lawfulness of this program. For people who don't know, it's based on something that's been happening in the city of Melbourne since kind of the beginning of the year. So we have a little bit of a sense of how it's worked there, but we don't know if it's going to be replicated exactly the same here. But based on what we know so far, legal centres think that local laws do not empower council to do the things it is seeking to do. Council has also specifically said it does not need to or intend to consider the impact on human rights. So people would know there's a Charter of Human Rights, and council has certain responsibilities under that. So, you know, council is risking litigation being launched against it and other councils that are implementing similar programs. This proposal seems to be part of a trend to increase what are essentially policing powers of non-police and thereby to expand surveillance and punitive responses kind of via the back door. Council officers, I'll talk a little bit about the powers that we think they have. Council officers have powers to request that people move on, but our assessment is they do not have any power to physically interfere with people or force them to leave a place. Council officers also have powers that weren't used much in the City of Melbourne pilot to fine people, confiscate their belongings and prosecute them at court, which obviously further punishes and exacerbates people's poverty, but also wastes council resources as courts and Fines Victoria routinely dismiss those matters. Security guards have no additional powers to what any person in this room has. They can make a citizen's arrest like any person in this room can. No additional powers. Importantly, there is no power to arrest people for breaches of local laws. But what seems clear is that this program seems to at least threaten, perhaps actually arrest people for things that police wouldn't and can't arrest people for. What this project actually relies on is not powers under the law, but the intimidation that security guards bring to bear on people. Affected community members who had, you know, contact with the security guards in the City of Melbourne told legal centres that security and council officers relied on publicly humiliating, degrading and intimidating people to pressure them to leave a place. The City of Melbourne Mayor's promise that council officers will carry handcuffs in that LGA when they have no power to use them and will be immediately sued if they do, confirms that this is a strategy of optics and fear. This will inevitably also result in breaches of protected human rights. There's many that could be affected: privacy and reputation, protection from degrading or inhuman treatment, freedom of movement, equality before the law, peaceful assembly and association, whatever, the list goes on. None of this increases safety for anyone, and in my view, it's reckless at best in terms of its regard for its lawfulness. Aside from the legal problems, it's not an effective approach, even if your goal is only to ensure some people's safety. Approaches that punish people, infringe on their rights, and cause further trauma produce more of the behaviour that council is concerned about. Recidivism rates and extensive research make clear that carceral responses produce more crime by further isolating people from the supports they need and subjecting them to more violence and trauma. Nick Rees, the City of Melbourne Mayor, is openly invoking the debunked 80s theory of broken windows to justify his council approach. For people who don't know, broken windows argues that maintaining order by policing low-level offences can prevent more serious crimes. In fact, what this approach produces is massive over-policing of racialised and impoverished communities and does not reduce crime. Police have kind of basically abandoned it, yet our councils are reviving a tactic known to be discriminatory and ineffective and mainly a show of force. The evidence is clear that what actually works is redirecting money from carceral and punitive strategies and investing it in the specific community supports that address and in the long term prevent the hardship and suffering underlying people's behaviour. It's called justice reinvestment. It's been really successful in lots of places around the world where there's been kind of crime and entrenched structural disadvantage. If you want to have a look at an example from Australia that's been running for a long time, the Marangooka project in the New South Wales town of Bourke has been incredibly successful in reducing poverty-related offending by addressing the social drivers behind that behaviour. The reason why that's successful and this approach isn't successful is because crime and so-called antisocial behaviour are symptoms of an unequal society. We address them by addressing inequality, not by ascribing individual responsibility, you know, to people. We know that Footscray's social need is bigger than council can solve alone, but council has a responsibility to advocate to government about what actually works, not to buy into moral panics which exploit people who have experienced harm to advance a gentrification agenda. This program will not achieve safety for anyone in our community. It is a project to further gentrify Footscray by eradicating certain people from this community who have as much right to be here and live here as anyone else.
There you have it. There you have it. Government-paid paramilitary thugs and harm to victims, or justice reinvestment. The evidence is pretty clear. We, of course, should help those in need and not intimidate them. Okay, so thanks a lot for listening. Breadline is the program of the Australian Unemployed Workers Union. Unemployed people are welcome to join. You can visit auwu.org.au. And the next program coming up is Eritrean Voices.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.